This episode features discussion of kidnapping and extreme violence that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13.
The Philippines, 2001. Gracia Burnham crouched in the corner of a small hospital room as bullets whizzed overhead.
The walls shook as plaster flurried around her. The room filled with a thick dust that made it hard to breathe. She heard a sickening crack as one of the insurgents who had taken her hostage fell to the floor.
Blood leaked out from the back of his head and pooled around her shoes. A bullet had pierced his skull, and now he laid on the concrete floor, choking to death as his brain failed and oxygen left his body.
Gracia began to pray. Not to make it out alive, but to die quick. One bullet to the head, so fast she wouldn't know what hit her.
A bullet whizzed by her face, piercing the wall next to her. She cried out for her husband, Martin, who was nowhere to be found. She was trapped in a nightmare. Her screams seemed to evaporate as they left her mouth. She was alone, kidnapped, separated from her family, and about to be killed by friendly fire or beheaded by military insurgents.
Little did Gracia know that she would survive this ordeal, that this bullet-encrusted hellscape was only the beginning, that she was about to be abducted by the most violent militant group in the country and disappear into the depths of the Philippine jungle.
This is Hostage, the new Parcast podcast telling the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in hostage negotiations and what the human brain does when held captive.
We're your hosts. I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can listen to all of Parcast podcasts on your favorite podcast directory. New episodes come out every Thursday. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
This is our first episode on the kidnapping of Gracia and Martin Burnham, American missionaries taken hostage by religious extremists in the Philippines in 2001.
On May 26, 2001, Martin and Gracia Burnham celebrated their 18th wedding anniversary at Dos Palmas Resort in the Philippines. The next morning, May 27th, the Burnhams were ripped from their beds by military insurgents. What followed was a year-long ordeal in the depths of the Philippine jungle as the Abu Sayyaf attempted to negotiate ransom for the Burnhams' release.
This week, we'll look at Gracia and Martin Burnham and the missionary work that brought them to the Philippines. We'll learn about the militant group that abducted them and the first week of their year-long kidnapping.
Next week, we'll explore the hostage negotiations that took place between the militant group and hostage negotiators. A rapidly changing political climate thrust the Burnhams into the spotlight as they became the only people in history to have ransom paid for by the U.S. government. When Gracia was ripped from her hotel room in May of 2001, a million questions flooded her mind as she grasped to understand what was happening around her.
The one thing she kept thinking over and over again, who were these armed insurgents who were taking them hostage?
She would learn all too soon. Gracia and Martin had been captured by members of the Abu Sayyaf, a radicalized militant group who believe their bloody extremist tactics hold up the tenets of Islam. Their name means bearer of the sword, and they operate out of the southern Philippines.
Islam is one of the oldest religions in the Philippines, largely concentrated on the islands of Sulu, Mindanao, and Palawan.
When the Philippines gained its independence in 1946, Christian politicians won almost every seat of public office, leaving the large Muslim population with no representation in government. The Muslim people saw this as a grand injustice.
By 1975, a small military resistance group, The Moro National Liberation Front, or MNLF, had banded together to fight the onslaught of Christian settlers in Muslim areas. Their demands were simple. Sulu, Mindanao, and the island of Palawan be allowed to secede from the Philippines and create an independent Muslim nation.
The Abu Sayyaf are a group of radicals who broke off from the MNLF in 1990. They are an invisible army, able to blend in with the local population and operate almost undetected. They carried out their first terrorist attack in 1991, killing two American evangelists with a hand grenade.
The Abu Sayyaf are extremists in every sense of the word. They quickly became known as a brutal militant group, engaging in kidnappings that almost always ended in beheadings.
This was the organization that would capture Gracia and Martin Burnham and hold them hostage for 1 year and 11 days while their families and the U.S. government frantically attempted to buy their freedom.
But as happens in so many hostage negotiations, communication would break down time and time again. Shifting global politics would complicate negotiations, and the window for successful return would get shorter and shorter until it slowly disappeared altogether.
Gracia Jones was born on January 17, 1959, in Cairo, Illinois, to a devout Christian family. Her father was a Christian minister who instilled in his daughter the importance of living a life of service.
By the time Gracia was 18, she knew she wanted to study Christian education at Calvary Bible College in Kansas City and teach God's word to his followers around the world. While attending Calvary Bible College, a friend of Gracia introduced her to Martin Burnham. The two hit it off right away and became fast friends. Gracia learned that Martin was the son of Christian missionaries who were currently serving in the Philippines.
Their friendship quickly boiled over into romance, and the two became inseparable. They graduated from Calvary in 1981 and were married a short time later, in 1983.
Almost immediately, they decided to follow in the footsteps of Martin's parents and do missionary work in the Philippines. After their wedding, they began training as missionaries with New Tribes Mission. The New Tribes Mission training boot camp was intense. Volunteers spent a year living in an isolated, bare-bones campsite.
It was designed to simulate a high-pressure environment, reflective of the remote areas where they might work. The brutal conditions quickly determined who was cut out for missionary work overseas.
At the time, Gracia and Martin Burnham had no idea that they were learning the skills that would help them survive a brutal year-long kidnapping.
Having grown up in the Philippines with his missionary parents, Martin was prepared for the exaggerated conditions of the New Tribes campus and helped Gracia adjust. The couple passed their year-long program with flying colors.
Sometime in the early 80s, Martin Burnham had also gotten his pilot's license. Although it's unclear when or where, New Tribes considered him an expert pilot and assigned him the job of missionary pilot.
Missionary pilots have a notoriously hard and dangerous job. They're responsible for delivering food, medicine, and other supplies to missionary camps in the most remote regions on Earth. Oftentimes, they have to fly in non-ideal weather and make harrowing landings on muddy, overgrown landing strips that are far shorter than they should be.
But Martin and Gracia were excited to begin their work, and so in 1986, they boarded a flight for Manila, then on to Luzon, where they would be based.
They would spend the next 15 years in the Philippines, committed to their ministry and their growing family. In that time, they would welcome three children into the world, Jeff, Mindy, and Zach. Their lives were full of love and purpose. Their work was fulfilling, if a little dangerous.
Martin flew to the most remote parts of the Philippines, while Gracia worked the radios and took supply orders. Gracia does remember a night when the two had a close call while Martin was on a supply run.
The flying conditions were far from ideal that night as Gracia spoke to Martin over the radio.
Suddenly, the radio went dead. She checked her connection, but everything was working on her end. That's when she started to worry. If she was operational, the problem was inside Martin's plane.
And sure enough, Martin's plane engine had cut out. It lost power completely. Gracia prayed, helpless on the ground, as Martin careened through the air without a functioning engine. He was forced to fly blind and land the plane without power.
He tried to navigate towards the impossibly small landing strip, tricky to maneuver even under the best of circumstances. Gracia heard his plane and came rushing outside, watching as the aircraft jerked its way downwards.
For a moment, she wondered whether she was about to watch her husband free fall to his death. His plane was headed straight for a fence at the end of the airstrip. He wouldn't survive the crash. But Martin, ever the pragmatist, didn't panic. He prayed. And as if by some miracle, the plane missed the fence by a hair and glided onto the airstrip.
Gracia and a few other missionaries ran to greet him, a wave of relief rushing through her. It was the closest she had ever come to losing Martin, and the very thought of it shook her. Martin, on the other hand, was even-keeled as ever. After the crash, other missionaries began calling him Mr. Cool.
In late May 2001, Martin was asked to fill in for a jungle pilot on the island of Palawan, about 500 miles south of their home in Luzon.
They were happy to help out. The Burnhams had been to Palawan before and were familiar with the lush island.
Besides, their 18th wedding anniversary was coming up, and they had plans to steal away to a resort called Dos Palmas to celebrate.
Excited to take a night for themselves, they left their three children with a co-worker and made the trip south. They arrived at Dos Palmas on May 26, 2001, and enjoyed a beautiful evening together at the luxury resort.
In hindsight, Gracia Burnham ogles at the fact that the resort was much more expensive than anything they would usually book. But because it was their anniversary, they decided to make a rare splurge. This one whimsical decision ended up changing the course of her entire life.
Very early the next morning, on May 27th, the Burnhams awoke to heavy knocking on their hotel room door. Gracia looked to Martin, confused. She told Martin to throw on some clothes and answer the door. The pounding got quicker, harder.
Martin opened the door and was shoved inside by armed militants who thrust semi-automatic rifles into his face. They grabbed Martin, pulling him out of their bungalow. Gracia watched, speechless, as her husband was dragged across the floor.
Another militant ripped Gracia from her bed and pushed her out of the bungalow. He screamed for her to walk. She stumbled, trying to catch her footing. She felt a sharp pain on her shoulder blade. He had hit her with the heel of his gun. She heard screams echoing around the resort, drowned out by the sound of her heart pounding in her ears. She couldn't grasp what was happening. This seemed impossible.
The scene outside the bungalow was chaos. Tourists being shoved at gunpoint, screaming, clinging to one another as they were thrown to the ground, kicked towards a few boats awaiting them on shore. Dozens of people were being kidnapped en masse.
Gracia felt sick and panicked and angry. She wasn't going to let this man scare her. She was going to hold her ground. The more the man screamed at her to hurry, shoved her with his gun, kicked at her, the slower she would walk. She could feel the tip of his gun in her back, but she was relentless. She was not going without a fight.
She has since said that in hindsight, it was a life-threatening decision, but she wanted to be defiant. It is perhaps this level of bullheadedness and determination that would best serve her in the ordeal yet to come.
According to psychology lecturer Dr. Rachel Sharman, a small amount of the population is wired to fight in the face of emergencies and crisis situations. These tend to be people who are generally more open to new experiences and extroverted in their daily lives.
As a missionary worker who had left behind the comforts of home to live frugally in the Philippines for 15 years, Gracia certainly would have fit that description.
Luckily for Gracia, her natural instincts make her much more likely to survive during a crisis. In any given crisis, roughly four distinct personality types emerge. The first is the lone wolf personality. Lone wolves, usually about 1% of the population, are quick to abandon the group and try to find their own way to safety. They tend to defy instruction and inadvertently put themselves in harm's way.
The second personality type is called frozen fright. About 10% of people become so scared during a crisis, they go completely incapacitated, unable to move or speak. They endanger those who stay to help them and are often left behind.
The third personality type is the sheep, about 80% of the population. These are people who await instructions during a crisis and refuse to make decisions for themselves.
The last 9% are leaders, like Martin and Gracia. They rise up during an emergency and tend to be strong, defiant, and take care of the group as a whole. They keep the group together. If ever in a crisis, identify a leader. They are your best chance for survival.
But despite being a natural leader, Gracia couldn't help but feel sick. Her head was spinning as she fought to keep her cool. She was shoved into a small motorboat, relieved to see Martin already crouched down inside. She clung to him as reality crept in. Her heart was in her throat as she watched the men load her and her fellow vacationers onto boats. She realized who had taken them hostage. One of the most notorious militant groups in the world.
We'll delve into the horrors that awaited the Burnhams after this.
Now, back to the story. On the morning of May 27, 2001, Gracia and Martin Burnham were kidnapped by the extremist group Abu Sayyaf, one of the most deadly terrorist organizations active today.
They were loaded onto a speedboat that carried them out to sea. Gracia remembers the feeling of dread that overtook her as the boat headed into open ocean. The Abu Sayyaf were notorious for beheading hostages, and Gracia fought to keep those images out of her head.
According to a study published in the Journal of the Royal Society of Medicine, at the onset of a crisis, many people experience a prolonged stage of denial. They are unable to accept or acknowledge what is happening around them, allowing the individual to delay an onset of panic or pain. It's a survival response to extreme stress.
Famously, many hostages in the Moscow theater hostage crisis in 2002 believed that, at first, the arrival of heavily armed Chechenian militants were part of the musical performance. Even after it became apparent that the threat was real, many people remained in denial about the siege.
It's likely that this prolonged denial is also what helped Gracia keep her calm through the first few hours of her kidnapping.
Eventually, one insurgent stood before the group of hostages and introduced himself as Abu Suleiman, the leader of this particular faction of Abu Sayyaf. He told the hostages that they were an Osama bin Laden group.
At the time, that meant nothing to Gracia, who had never heard of Osama bin Laden.
Suleiman began asking the hostages who they were and what they did for a living. Most of the other hostages were wealthy Filipino families.
Suleiman was disappointed to learn that Martin and Gracia were American missionaries. He knew that missionaries lived a meager existence and had very little money for ransom.
Immediately, Gracia's heart dropped. If she and Martin weren't valuable hostages, they would likely be beheaded, possibly turned into a political stunt.
But then Suleiman made a decision that was arguably worse. The Burnhams would become their political prisoners. He would get what money he could from the other hostages, then use the Burnhams as political capital. They would be dealt with last, and that could take years.
Gracia breathed a sigh of relief, knowing they would at least survive the night. but she also knew that if they were to be dealt with last, they were at the beginning of a very long, grueling nightmare. Gracia remembers thinking of her kids, knowing it could be a very long time before she saw them again.
According to psychologist John Leach, a specialist on how humans respond to emergencies, Gracia Burnham's body was probably going into survival mode. When faced with impending doom, our sympathetic nervous system takes control of our reactions. The sympathetic nervous system is in charge of our fight or flight response.
At this point, Gracia's body would have started releasing three chemicals: adrenaline, norepinephrine, and cortisol.
The adrenaline and norepinephrine amps up the body and prepares it to fight. Cortisol helps control blood sugar levels and assists with memory formulation, so the brain can focus on the task at hand. For Gracia, that was staying aware of her surroundings and keeping calm. The last thing she wanted to do was call attention to herself or give her captors any reason to believe she was more trouble than she was worth.
The first night passed on the speedboat, all the hostages huddled together on the damp floor of the boat. They tried to sleep, despite being heaved back and forth in the choppy water.
At sunrise, tensions were still high, but the hostages took advantage of the morning quiet to take stock of one another. The Burnhams introduced themselves to the only other American on the boat, Guillermo Sobrero. He had been captured with his fiancée, a Filipino native named Faye Rosadina. Gracia and Faye felt an immediate connection, one of the few moments of peace that would cut through those first few days of anguish and uncertainty. They became fast friends.
But the quiet morning would be quickly interrupted when members of the Abu Sayyaf began throwing large plastic tarps over the hostages and threatening them to stay still and quiet.
Gracia knew what they were doing and was more than happy to comply. She could hear boats passing them on the water and held her breath. It was the Philippine military. It might seem odd, but the last thing she wanted was for their kidnapping effort to be found out.
This might seem hard to reckon with, but should the Philippine military realize they had encountered the Abu Sayyaf, a gun battle would likely ensue, and they took little care in avoiding hostages. At this point, the military was in an all-out war with the Abu Sayyaf.
Between 1998 and 2008, the Abu Sayyaf would be responsible for over 600 kidnappings and ransom attempts in the southern Philippines. By the time Martin and Gracia Burnham were captured in May 2001, kidnapping had become one of the major sources of income for the terrorist group, which became a huge problem for the Philippine government. Much like the rest of this war, the origins of the problem are found on the island of Sulu.
As we've discussed, Sulu is home to the majority of the country's Muslim population, and it's also dirt poor. The poverty in Sulu reached new heights in the 90s and early aughts, after years of guerrilla fighting between MNLF, Abu Sayyaf, and the Philippine Army.
Part of what makes Abu Sayyaf so treacherous is that they had begun to do something that the Philippine government had so far failed to do: help the impoverished population of Sulu. The local community on Sulu began receiving money from the ransoms the Abu Sayyaf was collecting.
This terrorist organization was actively working to bring their Muslim brothers out of poverty. Because of this, they won the loyalty of the local people.
Well, recently, we've seen this tactic repeated in the Middle East, wherein a militant group wins favor with the local people by overtaking a city and improving its infrastructure. The most recent group to do this was the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria.
ISIS. It might seem impossible, but according to reporter Rukmini Kalamaki with the New York Times, when they overtook Mosul in June 2014 and established their caliphate, the world watched in horror. And while they were inarguably malevolent rulers who used violence to subdue the citizens of Mosul, they also made vast improvements to the city.
They cleaned up the streets, started a regular garbage collection, and by many accounts, did a better job of policing than the corrupt cops who preceded them. It was the first time in recent memory that citizens could involve police in a crime without needing to pay a bribe. Of course, the citizens of Mosul were still thrilled to be out from under caliphate rule when ISIS was overthrown in July 2017. For most, living under ISIS was a violent nightmare. But during their 3-year reign of the city, ISIS were able to win the hearts of many men who sympathized with their cause and wanted to fight.
Their caliphate became a hugely successful recruiting tool for ISIS. And similar to what happened in parts of Mosul in 2014, the citizens of Sulu started to hide members of the Abu Sayyaf, lie for them, tip them off to the army's movements, and help the Abu Sayyaf fight a war against the Philippine government.
This gave the Abu Sayyaf the upper hand in almost every skirmish that took place in the region. Soldiers captured by the Abu Sayyaf were beheaded, their bodies mangled beyond recognition.
Hostages often fared no better, usually beheaded on YouTube for effect. For this reason, the army made little effort to spare the hostages any gunfire. They shot indiscriminately at the Abu Sayyaf. If hostages were hit in the process, so be it. At one point, friendly fire was thought to be killing more hostages than the army saved.
After spending 5 days at sea, the speedboat finally landed at Basilan, 400 miles south of Dos Palmas Resort. This area is where most of the captors were from. They knew the place well.
The Abu Sayyaf led the hostages into the jungle and allowed them to begin cleaning up in a river. For one brief moment, everything was calm, but the respite was to be short-lived.
A bullet whizzed by Gracia's ear, then another. Bullets began pelting the water. Gracia whipped around. She saw the Philippine army running out of the jungle towards the Abu Sayyaf.
Just as she had feared, they began spraying bullets indiscriminately. She ran out of the river and dove to the ground as a barrage of bullets flew overhead, slicing the trees around her.
The Abu Sayyaf quickly returned gunfire, fanning out into a huge semicircle, sending crossfire in every direction. The scene devolved into utter chaos. Bullets flew overhead, a spider web of gunfire. Gracia and Martin Burnham were as likely to be shot by an insurgent as they were by friendly fire. Martin and Gracia began to run.
Gracia's heart was in her throat. She could feel it pulsing, ringing in her ears. This was a nightmare. She knew that the army would be more preoccupied with killing Abu Sayyaf than saving hostages, but she wasn't expecting to be shot at like fodder. Martin said that if they wanted to survive, they needed to listen to the Abu Sayyaf, that there was no chance of escaping right now, with bullets ricocheting off the rocks and pelting the tree line. They would almost certainly be shot in the melee. All they could do was take orders from their captors, who would know how to guide them to safety.
The insanity of the situation began to sink in. As shockwaves from the semi-automatic machine gun shook through her body, the panic that had been simmering for days spilled over. Gracia fell to the ground in hysterics.
But Martin refused to let her give up. He laid down next to her and said, quote, "Gracia, now is not the time for crying. You can cry later. Now let's just get out of this," end quote.
Martin's words cut through. The jungle snapped back into focus. Gracia got up and started following an Abu Sayyaf insurgent who was leading the hostages away from the skirmish. She hung on her captor's every word.
She recalls running behind him, Martin by her side. Every few minutes he would call, "Drop," and they would hug the ground as bullets whizzed overhead. Miraculously, they all made it through the jungle alive, until the trees gave way to a dirt road.
A bus pulled around to meet them, and the hostages and Abu Sayyaf began pouring into the vehicle. But not every hostage fit into the bus. Gracia heard someone cry, "Just leave them." Gracia caught a glimpse of what happened next.
The Abu Sayyaf took two hostages, both Filipino nationals, Sonny Docker and Armando Bayona. They dragged them into the woods, screaming. but their screams were cut short. The Abu Sayyaf beheaded them on the spot. It was the punishment Gracia feared the most, and she had narrowly escaped it by one bus seat.
Soon, the bus pulled into a small village, and the shell-shocked hostages arrived at a hospital. The Abu Sayyaf charged inside, rounding up the doctors, medical staff, and patients, and corralling everyone into the same room.
The Abu Sayyaf had hoped that a hospital would be an ideal place to go to talk with political officials, gain national attention, and begin the negotiation process for many of their hostages.
But the negotiation attempts were quickly stymied. The army cut the phone lines to the hospital, isolating the hostages and cutting off any hope of negotiating with the Abu Sayyaf over the phone.
Gracia recalls the militants growing increasingly angry, and she realized none of this kidnapping was going according to plan. The Philippine army then pulled up outside the hospital and began encircling it, firing into the hospital. The Abu Sayyaf shot back, and the hostages huddled together in a corner.
Plaster rained down on them as bullets pelted the walls. Gracia was convinced that this was the moment she was going to die. She remembers hoping that when death found her, it would be painless and quick. At some point during the melee, one of the insurgents told Martin to go outside and find a phone. He said to call the Philippine government and tell them that there were innocent hostages and patients in the building, and that the Geneva Convention forbids them from firing onto a hospital.
Martin went, and Gracia worried she would never see him again. It was far more dangerous outside, where bullets were ricocheting off buildings and cars. She hoped that the member of the Abu Sayyaf who went with him would keep him safe. This was the reality of the situation. Their captors had become their protectors.
Coming next, we'll continue with this harrowing journey.
Now back to the story.
When the Abu Sayyaf took the Burnhams and their fellow captives to a hospital, they had hoped it would be a safe place to hide. Instead, the Philippine army opened fire on the hospital, shooting at Abu Sayyaf and hostages alike. In a strange turn of events, Gracia Burnham realized that her captors had just become her best bet of getting out alive.
This is not an unusual phenomenon during hostage situations. In fact, many former hostages report feeling bonded to their captors long after the event is over.
Well, this condition is called Stockholm Syndrome. According to clinical psychologist Dr. Joseph M. Carver, emotionally bonding with a captor is a tactic for survival in a hostage situation. By bonding with a captor, the hostage is also humanizing themselves. In fact, in many situations, the police actually encourage hostages to bond with their captors, as it significantly increases their chance for surviving the ordeal.
Gracia was holed up in the hospital as gun battles raged outside. She prayed that if she was going to die, it would come quickly. Right on cue, an injured militant called Sniper was dragged into the room. His blood began pooling on the floor.
The Abu Sayyaf were being picked off one by one, and Gracia began to fear that the remaining insurgents would execute the hostages before the army had a chance to rescue them.
She could hear members of the militant group praying loudly in the hallway, preparing for death. She grappled with the realization that she might not see Martin again, that she could be executed before he had a chance to get to her.
Then, as if by some miracle, Martin came running back inside. In the same moment, another vehicle pulled up outside the hospital, bringing a fresh insurgence of Abu Sayyaf militants who began pushing the army away from the hospital.
A captor came in and ordered the hostages to run. Gracia, Martin, and the other hostages dove out of the hospital amid gunfire. They followed their captors towards the jungle on the outskirts of town. They had to hide between cars and buildings as they moved, bullets still flying around them from every direction.
Around them, other hostages were shot and fell to the ground, bleeding out on the road. The insurgents left them behind, pushing the survivors forward. Gracia knew that the moment they reached the jungle, the Abu Sayyaf would have the upper hand again. They would vanish beneath the thick canopy and be completely at the mercy of this murderous militant group.
And yet, Gracia said it never crossed her mind to try and escape. Suddenly, there was a whizzing sound, and something just behind Martin and Gracia exploded. Martin went tumbling to the ground, taking Gracia with him.
She hit the pavement and heard Martin say, "I'm hit. I'm hit." At first, she thought he was lying, using the explosion as an attempt to feign injury and escape.
But then she saw Martin's shirt begin to stain with blood, and she knew he had been hit by the shrapnel from whatever had exploded behind them. She began to cry for help, and one member of the Abu Sayyaf, Yusad, came over to look.
He flipped Martin's shirt open and assured him it was nothing, then ordered them to keep running.
Meanwhile, the only other American hostage, Guillermo Sobrero, had been shot in the ankle and was having trouble getting up again. His fiancée Faye and the Burnhams urged him to move, knowing that Abu Sayyaf would have beheaded him before they would allow him to remain behind alive.
Guillermo mustered every ounce of strength and kept running. The small group of hostages followed the Abu Sayyaf to the jungle, the Philippine army in hot pursuit. But the Abu Sayyaf knew the jungle well. They ducked through brush and dove onto hidden trails to escape.
The Abu Sayyaf had home court advantage. The Philippine jungles are notoriously thick and impossible to penetrate. In fact, the Philippines has a long tradition of radical insurgents and political parties using the dense canopy for cover, hiding out in the jungle for years.
Gracia knew that as the jungle swallowed them, they would be completely isolated from the outside world, helpless to escape. They were back at square one. No phones, no negotiations, no hope. The past 5 days had been for nothing. The days spent adrift at sea, the ordeal at the hospital, they were no closer to escape or to seeing their children again. And worse, Gracia worried that the Abu Sayyaf would retaliate. Their ranks had been picked off by the Philippine army. They were down a lot of men. What was to stop them from using hostages to get even with the government?
Gracia's thoughts raced as they plowed through the jungle. Her calves screamed. They jaunted up steep, rocky terrain. It was so muggy, she felt like she was drinking the air. And then came the most shattering blow yet. Gracia and Martin discovered how much the Abu Sayyaf wanted for their ransom.
They were asking the U.S. government for $1 million in exchange for the Burnhams' lives.
Gracia's heart sank. This was a phenomenal amount of money, and her family couldn't pay it. Nor could they ask for assistance from the government. As the militant group well knew, the United States didn't pay ransom to terrorists. As far as Gracia was concerned, the Abu Sayyaf had just as well signed their death warrant.
The United States has long abided by the policy that paying ransom only serves to fund terrorist organizations and incentivize terrorists to kidnap U.S. citizens. There is no evidence to clearly support this claim, though. According to political research publication New America, since 2001, Americans made up only 20% of all Western tourists kidnapped worldwide, but also comprised more than half of the hostages that were killed. The likelihood of a hostage being released has been far greater for countries that do pay ransom.
The Abu Sayyaf pushed the Burnhams and their cohorts further into the jungle. Gracia recalls days when her legs would burn from sunrise to sunset, nearly buckling under the grueling climbs up and down the mountainous terrain.
They had to keep moving for fear of getting caught by the Philippine army. They walked for days on end, trying to get lost in the bush. Gracia and Martin struggled to keep up with their athletic, teenaged captors who were accustomed to the jungle terrain.
During this time, hygiene deteriorated. The hostages were forced to eat with their hands, but were deprived of opportunities to bathe. They were sick constantly. Gracia remembers having stomach flus for the duration of her capture.
Because of the poor conditions, the hostages had constant strings of stomach viruses and intestinal problems. They were weak and dehydrated, as the Abu Sayyaf actively deprived their hostages of water. According to the book Prisoners of War by Ron Friedel, this is actually a common tactic used by militaries and governments alike to brainwash their prisoners. Depriving your captives of food, water, and adequate sleep can subdue them and make them easier to control.
On top of the depraved living situation, they were subjected to long periods of grueling exercise that broke them down mentally as much as physically.
These tactics are also used by many cult leaders to indoctrinate new members into their cult. We are most susceptible to abuse when we are mentally and emotionally weakened. We become disoriented and lose ourselves. It is at these low moments that captors can step in and say, "I know this seems hopeless, but I want to help you. I can help you, but you have to trust me." Hostages then begin to rely on their captors to solve the problem and are more likely to cooperate.
Yet, despite these brainwashing tactics, Gracia and Martin stayed strong. They leaned on one another for emotional and physical support. There were many days when Gracia woke up and told Martin she was going to refuse to move, that the Abu Sayyaf would have to kill her before she walked another step.
But ever faithful, Martin would coax Gracia to keep going. He would ask her to just walk a little ways more and keep faith that God would provide for them.
Without him, Gracia knows she would have died in the Philippine jungle in the first few days of their capture.
As the days wore on and the Burnhams lost weight, grew sick, and became shells of their former selves, Gracia remembers thinking it couldn't possibly get any worse.
Then, about 10 days into the ordeal, possibly because they saw him as a threat, the Abu Sayyaf began handcuffing Martin to trees, day and night. He would be handcuffed sitting up so that it became nearly impossible for him to move or sleep.
This further attempt at sleep deprivation finally broke Gracia. She knew they were torturing her and her husband for no real reason, other than wanting total control of their captives. She was furious. A part of her broke. She was going to refuse to walk in the morning. She would make them kill her. She wasn't buying into their game any longer.
That night, she sat down next to Martin as a member of the Abu Sayyaf came over to secure Martin's handcuffs. Gracia, filled with rage at the sight of him, but kept her anger in check. They would never get a rise out of her. She wouldn't give them the pleasure.
After the guard walked away, her anger released. She sat next to Martin, broken, exhausted. She didn't cry, but she wanted to. She kept telling him, "I'm not walking another step," and he would argue, "You have to."
Martin had always been her rock, the thing that kept her going. But this time, she didn't know if she had another day in her. Then they heard it, so quiet they almost didn't catch it, a very soft click.
Martin froze and quietly jiggled his wrist. Gracia nearly cried out when she realized, but threw a hand over her mouth to catch herself. Martin could get the handcuffs off. They were broken.
The click rang through Gracia's ears. She looked at Martin. He was saying something. She looked at him, a wave of relief and exhaustion washing over her. She heard what Martin was saying, but it didn't seem real. Escape. They had the chance to escape.
Next week on Hostage, we'll follow Martin and Gracia Burnham as they continue their trek through the Philippine jungle as hostages of the Abu Sayyaf, waiting for the perfect moment to escape.
And we'll follow the Burnhams as one of the most catastrophic terrorist attacks in world history changes everything and suddenly makes a negotiation for their release a reality.
You can listen to Hostage and all of Parcast's other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, CastBox, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast directory.
We'll be back next week.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted. Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Ron Shapiro and Joel Stein, with production assistance by Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Hostage is written by Aaron Land and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.